Do you know when you're in the pub and an old football match comes on, a rocket of a shot hits the bar and bounces out? And then somebody says, do you ever wonder what would have happened if that had gone in? Imagine if we'd scored that. What if we'd won that game?
Then everyone has an opinion. Well, the manager would probably have kept his job. We could have gone in to win the league that year. Ah, we still would have messed it up. We were shite anyway. Such fine margins that could have potentially massive consequences.
In this series, we look at some of the biggest what-ifs in football history. What happened? What could easily have played out very differently? And what we think might have happened instead? This is Outside the Box.
The 1988 UEFA European Championship Final.
And here's Robins. And did it get the deflection? Was it Robins or Pierce?
Attention. Attention, Kostadinov.
What?
Yes. No. No, the linesman says no. The linesman says no.
I think they should really stop flogging a dead horse, basically. It's over. It's finished.
Their opponents, not a Republic of Ireland team, not a Northern Ireland team, instead a combination of the two.
This week, what if there had always been one All-Ireland football team?
Hello and welcome to Outside the Box, the football podcast that looks at various points throughout history and asks, what if things had been different and things had gone the other way? I'm Dave Fleming and joining me as always is Mr. Jared O'Shea. Jared, hello.
Good evening, Dave. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much.
Exciting one for us this week. Many of our recent episodes, we've been looking at quite recent what ifs in history. This week, we're throwing the history books wide open. We're looking way back in time to something that begins about 100 years ago this year.
Ireland, Ireland, damp sod of earth, lost on the surf of the North Atlantic. Ireland, Ireland, mountains and mist.
The 1921 Irish Cup semi-final between Glenavon and Shelburne should have been just another big game between two of the era's leading lights of football in Ireland. Instead, it led to the partition of the game on the island, similar to the political partition of the country.
As the War of Independence took hold in Ireland, County Armagh-based Glenavon and Dublin-based Shelburne, the defending cup holders, drew their cup semi-final in Belfast. The Irish Football Association, based in Belfast, reneged on a commitment to hold a replay in Dublin and instead set the fixture again on Laggan-side.
And Shelburne refused to play. The Leinster Football Association, who already believed the IFA favoured the northern-based teams over those in and around Dublin, broke away from the governing body and established their own organisation, the Football Association of Ireland, based in Dublin. Until the early 1950s, both federations coexisted, both claiming that the national side they fielded represented Ireland, and choosing players from both sides of the border, which saw a number of players represent both the IFA and FAI's Ireland teams.
In 1953, the split was formalised at international level when FIFA ruled that neither team could be referred to anymore as Ireland, decreeing that the FAI team be officially designated as the Republic of Ireland, while the IFA team was to become Northern Ireland. Now, 100 years on from the original split, the FAI and IFA remain two bodies, two leagues, two countries. Almost every other sport on the island continued to be, and continues to be, governed and organised on an all-island basis. The GAA, naturally, with its close historic ties to nationalism, does so, while individual sports like golf also operate without a border.
Perhaps most interestingly, major international team sports like cricket, hockey, and especially rugby have one domestic structure across the island and one national team, with players from right across the island and across the identity divides, wearing one jersey, representing one country, playing under one flag.
But what if football on the island had never been partitioned? What if the IFA had somehow managed to put its internal squabbles aside and remain united, as so many other sporting bodies had done?
What if there was one league across the island? What if there was one governing body? What if there had always been one All-Ireland football team?
Joining us to discuss what might have been is an actor and writer from Talla in Dublin. He's appeared in such films as Dublin Old School and Between the Canals, as well as several television shows, including Love, Hate and Red Rock. He's a regular on the Irish stage, appearing in the Abbey Theatre numerous times, and he's worked for prestigious theatre companies such as Druid and Corn Exchange. One of his most acclaimed roles was that of Kino in the comedy musical I, Kino. He is a lifelong Shamrock Rovers fan, but restores balance to the universe by also supporting the less successful Super Hoops, Queen's Park Rangers. We're delighted to welcome Mr. Stephen Jones. Jonesy, hello, how are you?
How you doing, gents? Nice to be with yous.
Good. Well, Jonesy, you're a man I know from my own personal experience with good pals, who has very much a love of the national game here in the League of Ireland. I've been to a Rovers game with you and seen your lunacy firsthand. We've been to a lot of Ireland games together as well. It's safe to say you're a fairly big fan of Irish football in general.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it kind of comes from my dad was a Rovers fan for years and would travel around the country with them. As a teenager and kind of in his 20s and early 30s. And then he kind of took a break from it for a few years. And when I was starting to play football, 7, 8, 9, 10, around that age, it was a way for him to actually think we'll go back and start watching Rovers again. So I kind of went along and it sort of ties in with the QPR thing. My whole family are Manchester United fans when it comes to British football. But I wanted to be different, so I managed through family connections to support QPR, so that was a good decision, obviously. And so I said to my dad, I'm not going to follow Rovers, you know, I think I'll follow, and I just plucked Pats out of thin air. I think they're probably the champions at the time, you know, but I couldn't keep up the facade for long. I think going to the games live and learning the songs and, you know, these blokes that you see in front of you, not on the telly, but live, who become your heroes. It wasn't long before I said I had to admit that I was a diehard Rovers fan too. That was in the days when Rovers had no ground and I would go to games at Talca Park and I remember out in Santry and I remember getting beaten by Bows after being 4-1 up. Yeah, that was pretty bad. And I remember my dad being part of supporters clubs who were pushing to try and get the move to Talla, where we happened to be from as well. So, yeah, it was a great times when Talla Stadium opened. And obviously, Rovers then had a great run not too long ago with the Europa League run and just some memorable nights. Just it was great when Spurs came. But the one I remember the most in Talla Stadium was Pauk from Thessalonica in Greece. And they came and their fans were just mental. It was just unbelievable atmosphere. I felt sorry for any football fan that wasn't attending the game, you know. And there's been special nights in Dublin derbies and great games when Dundalk have been so good coming down to Talla Stadium and away trips are always great. So I always don't understand why diehard football fans don't get out and support League of Ireland more, because it's a far better experience live than it might be on the telly, where the quality is obviously not as good as the Premiership, you know. So yeah, that's my experience with it. Love it. Love going to the international games. I've been to many games with you, Dave. And as always with Irish football fans, it's the hope that gets you. It's the hope that killed you. But it's something you never lose. So it's something I've missed the last year. I have to say the last live game I was at was Rovers beat Dundalk 3-2. An absolutely phenomenal game with a couple of cracking goals in there.
Before we dive into this in great detail, League of Ireland is a big part of what we want to chat about, but I suppose to make clear what we're not doing is we're not doing a full 100-year rundown of the entire history of football on the island of Ireland. We're more going to kind of focus on key moments in that period and what might have been different had there been one structure, both for domestic and international level. And I suppose the other thing then is the politics of it is not something that we can divorce ourselves from. Again, largely we're going to be talking football stuff here, but the politics is not something we can ignore. It's part of the split. It's part of the continued probably split, certainly politically on the island. So we probably will be dipping in and out of that. But again, we're not gonna solve identity politics on Ireland over the next time chatting about this. So that's what we're not chatting about. What we are chatting about is maybe some of the missed opportunities, maybe some of the key moments in history of both Ireland, Northern Ireland, and the leagues in both jurisdictions.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's probably a good place to start is at the beginning. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with how the split originally happened or the origins of how football came to be in Ireland. I know I wasn't massively familiar with it, but it is quite interesting to look at it that Belfast was the centre of football in Ireland in the years up to the split. It's definitely where football was first played in Ireland. It was brought across from Scotland, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jens. It was one, was it McKinley? Was that his name? When he literally was one man, saw a game, says, I fancy that. Brought it back, organised an exhibition game in Belfast, and it moved from there. But Belfast was very much the centre of it. But this, I find it fascinating, this split where, yeah, it's Glenavon are playing Shelburne. Shelburne go up to Belfast, they get a draw, happy days, lads, get them back to Dublin, we'll stuff them and we'll go on and win the cup final. But the IFA say Dublin is too unsafe. The War of Independence is really raring at the time. So again, like Jerry said at the start, it's impossible for us to talk about this and completely divorce it from politics. We'll have to kind of put things in context. But yeah, the IFA in Belfast say, too dangerous to go to Dublin. We're playing the game again in Belfast. Belfast was also an incredibly dangerous city at the time. There was regular, Belfast Celtic had gunshots fired in the stadium at one of their matches. So not sure how real a reason that was. But anyway, reset it for Belfast. Shelburne say, we're not having that. We're not travel up again. And the split happens. I don't know how much, Jonesy, have you been doing a bit of reading on this in advance? What your thoughts on it are? It's kind of classic, the Blazers in action right from the get-go, or...
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount to that because, as you mentioned, like you can't divorce it from the political side, but there's huge kind of evidence from what I've seen and read, and I've read a little bit and listened to Cormac Moore, who's done a book about this split and the origins of it and the whys, and you know, he reckons that it's more about the internal politics as opposed to what was going on the island at the time. And yeah, like as you said, Belfast was just as dangerous as Dublin was at that particular period. So there's no doubt in my mind that it was purely about, you know, the suits in Belfast just pulling rank and basically wanting to have it their way. And so when you think about it, maybe it's coming from a biased perspective as we're from the South, but I kind of, as someone who doesn't like to give Shells a lot of credit, I think that, they were right, and the Leinster Association were right to kind of stand their ground on it, because it was, I don't think it was a fair enough reason. I think there were, you know, a level playing field is what anyone would be after. And I think, you know, they went to Belfast, they got a draw. The replay should have been in Dublin. But as you said, it was Belfast was the hub of it. And that's what you kind of forget. I know the old thing about, you know, England gave the world football. And even to think that the Irish Football Association up north, you know, like I think it was the fourth football association in the world. So it's really the origins of the sport that we love. And of course, like anything, when it's starting off and when you've got a messy political situation, it's something's going to go wrong. And I think it's the lads making the decisions in the boardrooms who've always been the problem. And I think that's the case in that scenario.
But I suppose when we look at then, you know, chances when things that we missed out then by not having a single team. And if we look at maybe the first World Cup after they're forced to play as two in 58, sorry, the second World Cup after that. I know we're looking back on a football here, but none of us probably certainly don't know a huge amount about the players playing in it. But, you know, straight away, the North get to the quarterfinals of the 58 World Cup. Is that a missed opportunity that an All-Ireland team could have done so much better?
It's kind of curious when you look at the, you know, again, a lot of these players, we're judging them on reputation rather than on our actual knowledge of them. But I know it's a little bit before Johnny Giles has broken into the Ireland team. I think he's only about 18 or so when he actually makes his debut for Ireland in 59, but he's still thereabouts. But Noel Cantwell is definitely one who was a top player playing for the Republic. Might he have made them a little bit better? I mean, there would have only been what, about maybe 16 teams in the 58 World Cup thereabouts.
Yeah.
So yeah, for Northern Ireland to reach the quarterfinal, it's still quite an impressive achievement. I'm not sure myself how much difference there might have been with I don't see Ireland are kind of internationally are in a little bit of the doldrums at the time. You still got the Gang of Five are selecting the players. And I know John Giles particularly spoke a lot about, there's a good documentary called Green is the Colour that Darren Maloney hosts. And the players they were so against this system where a manager was part-time and the players would arrive on the boat they'd play a match in England on the Saturday and then they'd get the boat over on the Saturday night and get into Dublin on the Sunday morning, and then the manager would meet them. And if they were, turns out that they were injured, well, tough, they were picked anyway, they had to show up, and they'd get together, they'd meet in Dublin at 11 o'clock, and then they'd nearly have to walk out to Dalyman Park in Phibsborough to play the match. And you had this gang of Blazers. We're probably going to talk about the Blazers a lot, these five people who didn't really have any connection to football other than they found themselves quite important picking the team. So I think the international scene, particularly in the Republic at that stage, was still of too kind of shambolic and haphazard a standard that I think Northern Ireland probably did about as well as they would have done. I'm not sure how much Ireland would have added to it. I don't know if either the rest of you have any opinions on that.
No, I sort of agree with that. I think it's easier for us to judge kind of later, like even like the 82 sides, because when you look at those squads, we've got a much better kind of reference point to the closer in some ways about the spirit of the teams, you know, and the quality of the players. Sometimes you go, sometimes with sides like Ireland or Northern Ireland or Scotland, it's almost a lack of individual quality that creates that special bond, whether it's a Jack Charlton or a Billy Bingham in charge. It's that actually, if we add two or three quality players to this and try and get the ball down, are we going to dilute what we have? So I don't know whether that's the case going back to the 50s, you know, whether it was adding to that underdog spirit. But then again, I don't know whether even with a United Ireland team, we would ever have, we would ever be anything but underdogs. So it's hard to know going back to that time, you know. Something I found very interesting just about it was just, it seems to be so seamless to work in other sports, obviously rugby. And I'm just interested in maybe, is it to do with, you know, the socioeconomic things as well as politics, you know, the idea of soccer being a very working class urban game. Is it something in the formation? Is it something in the mentality of soccer that leads it to be, allows it to be so influenced by, for in our island, you know, sectarian politics, for example? Is it specific to that sport? Why does it work in other sports without anyone batting an eyelid, really? Whereas here, it seems to be, even when it looked like it might happen and there was that friendly against Brazil randomly with the Shamrock Rovers Ireland 11, why has there always been snags along the way? That's what I've just been looking at and I'm wondering, you know, is it soccer itself that's the problem?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting point, because there was a couple of conferences where the two associations tried to get back together. But I kind of agree. Jeremy, Steph and yourself were talking about this a little bit last week when we were talking about this podcast. The major sports that have international teams that stay as an all-island organizations are cricket and rugby, both of which at the time, you would say, while perhaps being followed regularly in the newspapers and they would get good attendances, they were kind of minority sports. They were played usually by Protestant kind of unionist people, both in the South and in the North, where football is the first sport that comes along, apart from obviously Gaelic in this country, Gaelic football and hurling, but soccer, that has that absolute mass appeal. Exactly like you said, Jonesy, across working class people of all sides, all sides and none. So you get them all kind of thrown together in this close proximity that you don't really in these other sports. You have this, again, there's sectarian tensions in soccer already before the split happens, where the countries are separated, and before the split in the football associations, where you have Belfast Celtic suffering, where there's quite extreme violence in their stadiums during matches, and also the massive violence between the fans of like the Protestant clubs like was it Linfield and Glenavon and the Catholic club, the nationalist club of Belfast Celtic. So it's, I kind of wonder, we might go into this in a bit more detail afterwards, Jonesy, but I kind of wonder, yeah, is football part of the problem? Why the two associations didn't get together, and why there wasn't just one all-Ireland team?
Yeah, I think it's always hard to shake anything, even 100 years on. I think it's hard to shake whatever the culture of something is. You know, because it's hard to leave that the kind of legacy behind. So when we approach as little kids, we go to football for the first time, your experience of football, if it's a big rivalry, tends to be, you know, your dad not really, sort of, but not really covering your ears for the abuse that's being shouted. And it kind of becomes part of you know, rivalry is sort of associated with hatred. And it kind of goes to the point of, well, there'd be no problem with an All-Ireland League because, you know, Shamrock Rovers going to Linfield, it won't be any worse than, you know, a Linfield and Cliftonville game, you know? I don't know, maybe it's just, it is just part of the culture. What's the old cliche of a, you know, rugby being a gentleman's game played by thugs and football being a thugs game played by gentlemen or something like that, the other way around maybe. I think of, you know, the 82 World Cup, and I listened to Niall Quinn do an interview where he was saying, you know, I think that was Northern Ireland's performance and that, and beating Spain was a real, you know, a real boost and a real catalyst for the Republic lads saying, come on, we need to pull our socks up here and getting behind them. And even random ones, like he was saying after the one-all qualifier at Windsor Park, the captain of Northern Ireland, Alan McDonald, coming in to the dressing room, even after all the trick-or-treat stuff and the, you know, the real hostile atmosphere, coming in to wish them well and you'll be representing the island. And my friend Barry wrote a song for the last Euros, you know, like Two Shades of Green. And I was thinking most people sort of get behind the other Ireland, if you like, when they're playing in competition, as long as it's not against us. And I wonder, am I just being a bit, you know, shiny, happy people about that? But but certainly I think I'd like to see Northern Ireland do well. I mean, I like to see England lose every time they play. I think in terms of the man on the street, I think... there's been plenty of times where we would have said, this is a good idea, you know? Maybe, I don't know whether it's gone too far now, though, to ever have one team.
Yeah, it's something myself and Dave actually were just chatting about even earlier today about the 82 team. And it's just, when you mentioned that, was a team that it seems like that did have support from right across the island. And certainly within the North team, it was, you had the likes of Gerry Armstrong and Martin O'Neill from GAA and Catholic backgrounds. And by the time we get to that 93 one-all draw, the change then in the hostility and the very unwelcoming place to, you know, not just to the guys coming up from the Republic, but to Catholics within Northern Ireland, it was a much less welcoming team for them. And it kind of ties to something that I was thinking about a lot on this. Whether soccer was the problem to begin with, it became a bit self-perpetuating and self-fulfilling because it became politicized and it forced you to choose over time in a way that the likes of rugby didn't, that you could be, if you were, for example, from a unionist background, you could quite readily support the Irish rugby team and be an Orange, and you could define yourself as being Irish and British, if that's how you saw yourself. But soccer entrenched those differences that you had to choose. You had to identify yourself by a tribe. And if those differences may have been the suits to begin with, and, you know, the blazers in the room that we've talked about, over time, it has become a politicized sectarian thing. Now, whether it was there to begin with on a smaller scale, it's certainly there at points, the sort of 93, the bitterness of that. But then you get to 2016, and very much so, there was a, we're on it, we got each other's backs here.
Yeah, I think so. It's a really good point. There's a couple of things there. You mentioned Gerry Armstrong, who, you know, after that game, he got a great gig, didn't he, with Sky Sports on the Spanish football, living his best life. But yeah, he was saying, you know, that after that game, they were getting reports straight in. They were like, oh, look, there's, you know, the celebrations on the streets of Dublin, let alone Belfast, you know, for that. And then you think of 93, it's like, there seems to be, it's unfortunate events and terrible tragedies happen. But yeah, I think that soccer maybe... the culture has allowed itself to become uglier at certain moments, and it is a pity, you know.
Well, scarcely can I recall an international occasion, and I'm going back to childhood here in Belfast, when there's been an atmosphere quite like this. There may only be 11 odd thousand in the ground, a fair sprinkling of Republic of Ireland supporters who made it here, who've got their tickets somehow or other, but the noise is all overwhelming.
And then I think when sides had their success, like when Ireland under Jack Charlton, when we, like Euro 88, once that happens, or even with Northern Ireland, once they have a bit of success themselves previous to that, it's almost like, well, we're our own thing now. We're our own country. We're our own brand. Why do we need anyone else? Look at what we've done. You know, our shade of green is working totally fine. And the nation's hopes and the feel-good factor and, you know, especially on this island, kind of get wrapped up in those achievements because there's not that many of them. And so why would we want to disrupt that or break that or bring anyone else in? You know, it's almost like, you know, you weren't there for us when we were really rubbish. Now that we're only slightly less rubbish, you know, you're not going to share in our glory.
And we start tonight with a sports story, and what a sad tale it is. Northern Ireland and the Republic beaten last night and out of World Cup contention.
These parallel tales of Irish footballing woe have sparked debate once again about a combined Irish football team.
When one or both don't qualify, it's like, well, and it usually, to be fair, it usually comes from the South about, well, if we had the North, we would have qualified. But it tends not to be. In Euro 88, had we had a couple of the guys from the North, how much better might we have been? Or the North in 82 and 86, how much better might they have been? But if we kind of take it that actually the North in the first half of the 80s and the Republic in the second half of the 80s and the early 90s are probably the best that they've ever been, do we think that either of those teams could have been improved by there being an All-Ireland team? And how much further could they have gone if they were better?
I think, Ger, you brought this up before when we were chatting about it as well, which I think was very interesting and possibly true, if a little controversial, is Northern Ireland qualify for 82 and they do really, really well. But there's an argument to be made that the Republic team at the time were actually better. We came so close to qualifying for that World Cup. Owen Hand, probably the unluckiest manager in Irish history. We had so many quality players in that team. That was a time where Liam Brady was a world-class player, but apart from that, maybe Mark Lawrence as well. But yeah, you've said that, Ger. Would a Republic team have qualifying for that World Cup with a couple of the best Northern Irish players have actually been a better team? Or would they just have got to the quarterfinal as well anyway? Is that our limit?
Well, I think that's the one. That's the one that stands out for me, looking at the squads, you know, where one side has done as qualified. That's the one where I look at it and think, look at the four or five Republic of Ireland players, and you say to yourself, yeah, Brady and Stapleton, I don't know, Highway, Lawrence, and it's like, this is the one time I could think that a combined 11 could have potentially done better. The rest of the times, I think that there's a very similar sort of two or three players here or there.
The one that sticks out for me, now again, I know feck all about the two squads except for a couple of players, but it can only go by the results at the time, is the 1966 World Cup in England. Ireland have the straight shootout with Spain where they win at home, they get hammered away, and then there's the controversy over the playoff then that happens in Paris, and apparently the FAI got a suit full of cash to play it in Paris, and we get bet 1-0. But Northern Ireland had a brilliant run in the qualifiers for that World Cup as well, where they finished second, I believe, to Switzerland and ahead of the Netherlands. They won all their home games. The only thing that stopped them from qualifying was that they drew away with Albania, whereas everyone else beat Albania. You wonder, you had Johnny Giles really playing close to his best at the time, and also you had George Best playing absolutely brilliantly. Two genuine world-class players in the same team, which is maybe around the Italian 19, the Euro 88 team, happened for the Republic, but otherwise has never happened in history. And also the fact that the World Cup is so close to home in England, how we might have done in that. I know it's complete conjecture and speculation, obviously, but how we might have done in that tournament if we qualified as an All-Ireland team.
It's actually the one I mentioned that I was going to be talking about this with you lads tonight. And it's like, that's the one thing that people who maybe don't even know anything about football as such would say, would that mean Georgie Best would be playing for, you know, Ireland? And it's like, that's the one that would intrigue me, that combination. But it comes back to a thing. It's like, international football is so funny. The difference between qualifying and not is big. So is getting to the last 16 and the quarterfinals at this level, you know? So it's hard to know. I think it's more about, did we miss an opportunity also through sport to make a better political situation in the country earlier? That's another way to look at it, you know? The power of sport and what it would have done.
Yeah, and that's something I've probably been banging the drum a lot with Dave as we've been researching this. I think that's arguably where the biggest difference comes in, actually, because I just think, like, we see it with the Good Friday Agreement and stuff like that. The more points of difference are erased and blurred, just the smoother everything becomes.
Yeah, I completely agree, Jerry. You made really good points on it when we were talking before about, and you said it on this as well, suddenly having to choose, having to identify as Northern Irish or Irish is a big political statement to make. And if you don't, and again, the biggest mass participation sport in the world is making that choice. And it's mostly, again, working class men back then and on both sides now making this decision to identify as one or the other. And if they don't have to make that decision, where it's something that they're following every week and they're going to the grounds regularly, they're constantly identifying, as how much tension is taken out of a situation if that point of difference is not there. Like, yeah, Jerry, like you said, you've been banging this drum, but I think it's a really important drum to bang. There's a lot in it.
Yeah, and look, there's clearly there's civil rights issues and all that sort of stuff that isn't just going to be magically gone away by, you know, we're clearly football fans. We think sport is very powerful, but, you know, it can change the world in small ways, but it's not going to solve everything. But again, if you can be, if you aspire to a United Ireland and you're living north of the border, but actually every sport that you want to follow, you can be in an All-Ireland basis. Does it satisfy some of that? If you're a dyed-in-the-wool loyalist who wants nothing to do with the Republic, but actually every second international you have to travel to Dublin to watch your team playing, does it take away some of the fear and the mystery? And do both sides just sort of go, well, actually, it's much easier for us to be on the same side here? Again, it's not going to solve everything, but it's just another point of difference removed. And how big an impact it would have is questionable, but I actually think it would potentially have a bigger impact than on the football side of it.
Yeah, I think so too. Although I have to say that one bonus of us never having a United Ireland football team, apart from that kind of that one game or years and years ago, is that we don't have to have another sport where we have to listen to Ireland's call after a round of in. sorry, anyone who likes that. Yeah, I think I think the success of that Northern Ireland have had in recent times, again, against all odds, there's a certain identity in that is very much associated with the British side of the island and Windsor Park and that half of Belfast that I think will common ground ever be reached about, oh, well, we'll split between the Aviva and Windsor Park. You know, at this stage, I just don't see that happening.
For most of the past decade, League of Ireland games would do well to attract 2,000 people through the gate, but it wasn't always like that. In the 30s, 40s and 50s, the stands were packed out weekly. In 1958, an incredible 20,000 people bought tickets in advance to see Drumcondra play Shamrock Rovers, with thousands more showing up at Talca Park on the day.
That was the league's golden era, when the national side was made up of home-based players and the odd jewel who had made it to England. The league wasn't just popular, it was the place to be, especially in Dublin.
As a League of Ireland fan, you think an All-Ireland league would be beneficial to the game?
Yeah, I think so. I think more competition, and I think that it would just create an overall higher standard. I think it will create a better atmosphere in terms of, you know, new sets of fans having to interact with each other. Although there'll be rivalry and there'll be games where there's tension and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's part and parcel of the game. I just think that for the clubs who struggle a bit, then there's more competition. It could make the first division stronger as well. I just think it makes sense. I just think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about it now. Countries in Eastern Europe coming together to maybe combine two or three countries into a league just to try and increase the competition, increase the standard. I think it'll bring more attention to the game here, more interesting for the kind of armchair supporter who might get up and go and see a game. And so, obviously there's been times over the years where certain clubs have been a lot stronger and you don't want to see, you know, teams from the League of Ireland be the top eight in the league and then Linfield or someone ninth. Obviously you want a bit of balance in it, but I just think overall it would be better for the game. I think that it would improve the competition and the standard of play. I mean, there's a lot of eyes on the game now because a couple of lads have made the leap into the international. No one's really broke through to be a starter, but, you know, a lot of people have come close. A lot of people have thought recently that, you know, Jack Byrne should have been in the starting 11 for a couple of the games. And obviously players get moves to England and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, what do you guys think? Yeah.
I definitely think that, yeah, combining the North and South now is kind of the league structure is a no-brainer to improve the standard and just kind of drum up a bit of interest. I'm kind of, for the purpose of this podcast, I'm kind of curious what that standard would have been if it had been united from the very start, if it would have made the game a lot stronger domestically here. There was the period, the golden age was 50s and 60s when you had regularly 20,000 people attending League of Ireland games, big rivalry, Shamrock Rovers doing really well. It was a great Dundalk team, a great Waterford team. You had Irish teams kind of managing to get past the first round in European competition on a semi-regular basis, which is not really something that, that happens anymore. And then the money dries up, people go away, Match of the Day comes along, people start watching English football instead. They have it available on TV in their living rooms, and the league falls apart and has never really fully recovered since. But I'm curious, and I don't know the answer, but that's what this podcast is for, is about discussing this. What if we had an all-Ireland league constantly from the beginning, if the standard is raised enough that the two leagues, which are both basically kind of backwaters, are in a position where they're, like, well, what do we think it might have been? Like, Jerry, you had one before where you said, is it essentially Scotland without the Old Firm? Is that the standard we're looking at, or is that too ambitious?
I find it hard to see that it could be above that, certainly. And I don't even mean in the 80s when Hearts and Aberdeen and Dundee United were much better teams than they are. I think that's about the ceiling of it, personally. I do think the Match of the Day factor is an unbelievable factor in killing the game. It also probably isn't helped by the fact that the season Match of the Day starts is also the season when Best makes his debut for Manchester United. So whatever interest there might have been in English football, which was always there, you take the biggest star on the island, and I know Match of the Day partly makes him that star, but that's an unbelievable point in the center of gravity of football on this island, on these islands, gravitating massively towards England. So I don't think it would have survived. You know, the 50s League of Ireland would never have survived into the 70s because of the Match of the Day factor. You know, you can argue a case as well that had you only had one league, well, you'd have halved the number of teams who've got European football, in so much as it was only a game or two a season. But I absolutely, the more teams from across the island playing, you know, not a league of 10 teams playing each other three or four times. You know, if you had a top division across Ireland of 16 teams, I definitely think it's better. But, I don't think it's, you know, light years ahead of where it's at now, personally.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, when you look back on it, you see, even when the island was still united in football terms back in like the 1910s, even when pay for play was starting to come in, the best Irish players from Dublin and Belfast were still going to Manchester or London or Liverpool or Nottingham or wherever, because they were still offering better money even way back then. Even when the difference would have been a few pound a week, it was still massive. So I think, yeah, maybe even Scotland without the Old Firm is probably too generous. I think the standard would increase, and I think it would have been we mightn't have had the absolute plateaus that we had. But I think you're completely right, Jerry, that interest in English football, which is always, I mean, it was the foundation of the game. It was always been to have such a massive league right on our doorstep, and then to have TV access to it. It was always going to take the heart out of the game here. But if the standard was a little bit higher, if you had a regional rivalry of Dublin and Belfast, clubs from those two cities, that might have drummed up a bit more interest. I mean, we just might have had a bit of a higher bottom line, if that makes sense.
I think it would also. I think we'd have had more internationals from the domestic game probably coming through. But then would we have ever had what Jack Charlton brought to the Republic in terms of going, these players aren't good enough, and elevating us to a whole other level in terms of some of the players he brought through, admittedly on a strong base of the Irish players that had been there in the 80s. Yeah, I think certainly now there's a massive case to be made for it. But at this point, the financial argument is really about keeping heads above water in clubs, really, rather than in any way trying to narrow the gap on the big leagues. An All-Ireland League now, in fact, you could probably make a case for a rugby-like Celtic League where you bring in the Scottish clubs and what's available in Wales. Again, it's about a survival instinct. It's never going to close the gap, even on probably League Two or the Conference in England in terms of finance.
No, that's the big problem. I mean, there's still the great, like, you know, Dundalk reaching the Europa League, Rovers Europa League, teams from the north, you know, getting results in European games. That's always going to be there. But yeah, over the course of a season, the standard is going to be the lower end of League One, League Two, which is great when you go to the games. It's just about trying to drum up more interest in it. But I think, you know, more teams in the league, more opportunity for letting the kind of younger players into the squads and onto the pitch. But yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Like, you know, teams just struggling to survive, let alone thrive.
If you get a league that's 5% or 10% better, particularly now when young Irish lads are really struggling to break through in England, you know, a league that's that little bit better, all of a sudden, you know, you potentially are able to field international teams of a standard. You get a little bit more money in, and actually it's maybe in players' interest to not, you know, head off to England at 14 for a pipe dream and a lotto ticket, you might be as well staying off. Jack Byrne obviously is a good example of someone who came back. But if you could stay in the League of Ireland until 20 or 21 instead of 16 or 17, it's probably better for your development. It's certainly better for the clubs who are then able to sell a player to England for 4 or 5 million quid rather than 30 or 40 grand. And there is a way, the pathway to build things up gradually over time. Like, there's no reason why it can't be of a standard of the Danish league, for argument's sake. And they're the kind of transfer fees that the English player, the English clubs, the Spanish clubs actually do have to pay to bring in players from Denmark or Norway, because they're able to hold on to them for the couple of extra years that actually maybe a slightly better league is able to do.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, there's a couple of players I can think of who did that, some more success than others. You know, good pal of mine, I grew up with Dave Mooney, was at Rovers and then was at Longford when they won the Cup and was top scorer in the League of Ireland. So went to England then at 21, 22 and went on to have a good career, played at Wembley in a playoff final for Leighton Orient where they were actually 2-0 up against Rotherham and ended up losing on penalties. But played for a few different clubs, played under Brendan Rodgers at Reading and was at Norwich on loan and a few other clubs. Enda Stevens obviously was at Rovers for a good few seasons and then went off. Lots of other lads as well. So I think that's a really good point. I read somewhere that I don't think it will ever happen, but, you know, someone had floated the idea of some sort of Atlantic League where they were kind of using Ireland and Scotland and some of the lesser Scandinavian countries and in that region to try and talk about forming something there. But not that I think that's a good idea, but I think that the model of those leagues to look at, you know, it would be better for our international team, better for our young lads. Instead of being plucked away at 15, 16, obviously it's great for some. But others, yeah, I think, you know, to get into a side like Rovers, Get a game away at Daly Mount. Get a game away at Windsor Park. Let your body develop, and then off to England or Scotland, and the fans here get to see someone who goes on to play for Ireland or goes on to play for whoever, you know. Considering that most of our lads now are probably championship players, the level of the top lads in the League of Ireland is not that far off there. Most of the top players in the League of Ireland would get into League One sides and get into some championship sides. I think it's the way forward. I think it freshens everything up and it gives a new lease of life to some of the clubs who maybe are been a bit stuck for the last few years. Or maybe it doesn't work at all, you know what I mean? I mean, they tried obviously with the Setanta Cup, but I think sometimes on certain seasons that came along where one or two of the League of Ireland sides were really strong. Obviously, in an ideal world, you want it to be where Rovers and Dundalk and Bowes and Pats and Linkfield and Cliftonville and Glenavon and Glentoran are all of an equal standard. I mean, I think that's what would really make it if it was where no one was running away with the league, where it was really going to be, is it going to be Rovers or Linfield, you know, where there was huge interest beyond the diehard League of Ireland fans. That's the ideal scenario. Teams on both sides of the divide, if you like, you know, at a similar level. That's always been the problem with the league. It's always been Rovers dominating for a couple of seasons, Dundalk dominating for a couple of seasons, and the same in the north. It's kind of been the Linfield show for most of my lifetime anyway.
I think the whole of Ireland as a whole needs a full-time sort of league, you know, and it'll be good for the game. Obviously, you'll have politics and all coming into it, but they should be left out of sport. The league as a whole is improving, and it needs to have strong opposition instead of the likes of Linfield running away with the league or, you know, or Crusaders by Easter. You know, it needs good more than just a couple of teams challenging. So the standard is very good, and I would say when we play the Southern teams, we're on a par with them, no problem now, you know.
Well, I think for both associations, probably at this stage are for it. I think the players will be for it. I think the clubs are definitely for it. So it comes back to that: if someone's going to lose their job in a meeting somewhere, you know, whether they want to try and hold it back.
Yeah, I think the worst thing that could happen if there was an all Ireland league would be if one side dominated the early years to an extent that the other side would feel like it wasn't worth their while anymore. But I think something that could start a really positive domino effect would be if one or two players that were playing in an all Ireland league suddenly got into and did well in the national team. The publicity and the interest that would generate, I think, would be massive, where people would start, would be more interested in going to see these lads playing week in, week out if they were established internationals. I think, yeah, if you had that, like you said, Jerry, I think it'd be a really good point that if you get the lads staying an extra couple of years in Ireland, establishing themselves as professionals first before they go to the UK, but if we get a couple of years of them playing international football, that would be massive. That would be something that could see it going on in leaps and bounds. That'd be a real positive development.
One of the challenges, and we wonder, has this, we again, Dave, we discussed about this, is that one of the things that have maybe held football across the island back is how much of an urban working class sport football is. And it's clearly dominated by cities, but right across the island, actually, do we have enough large cities to even sustain the number of teams that are here? And I'm not suggesting for a moment we wind up some of the Dublin teams, but actually, if you look at an All-Ireland league, is the model of what's happened in rugby, where actually aggregating things into provincial level has elevated the standard as part of the international league. I mean, realistically, is Dublin too small a city to have, whatever it is, five top flight teams and expect them all to be strong?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, stumped me there, because, you know, it is a good point, you know. It's and when you add into that a large percentage of kids 15 or 16 who are playing for the top schoolboy clubs are more than likely going to England. It's like, where do the players come from? I mean, so there's always been a healthy balance, obviously, people coming back. But yeah, I wonder whether it's to do as well. I always think about rugby. It's bizarre to think that we're on an island where our team is one of the top teams in the world. It's a sport where actually we're internationally really good at. So does that feed into it as well, that it's a, you know, where are lads from Galway and Kilkenny always go to hurling? Oh, well, you know, they just are. If they're born with a hurl in their hand, it's like, I think we're still sort of, there's something in that. The fact that we have rugby and GAA as well as soccer, and culturally our soccer we never been world beaters. For a small island, you know, when you're starting to play sport, as you said, we simply don't have the numbers to produce the quality. But yeah, try telling a diehard fan of one of those clubs that we're going to mesh Rovers and Balls.
Yeah. But rugby, again, just not to harp back to it, but, you know, it had a very, very strong AIL, still on the go. But really, the IRFU almost decided that, you know, when professionalism comes into rugby, it's almost a ground zero here. And okay, we're going to keep the club game is going. But actually, if we want this to work internationally, this is the model. That you could all, you know, it would never happen for all of the historic reasons. But if the IFA and the FAI came together and we're coming together as one association, we want to maximize this to best effect, rather than having 100 kids going to 10 different clubs in Dublin, and actually the one kid is always going to be ahead of the others. You want all the best ones together. So Dublin is big enough to sustain two teams. We're going to have two teams in Belfast. We're going to have a team each in Derry, Galway, Waterford, Limerick, wherever. And that's where your 12 teams are coming from. But that will never happen. But actually, maybe to really capitalize on the potential of an all-island situation, that's almost what you need to do. There's a Dublin North side, Dublin South side, Belfast East, Belfast West, or whatever it is. And you try to get around the fact that we don't have the numbers by at least aggregating the numbers into as large a pool as you can at any one time.
Financially, it's probably the only way that would ever be possibly a big success. But it's a very franchise model, which football fans would, like you say, Jerry, would just never agree to. Would never happen.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Again, it's interesting. There's some sort of socioeconomic, urban, working class, cultural kind of project for someone to, a thesis for someone to write about on this, you know, just about the different type of tribalism that comes from different sports.
So all in all, I think I'd be for an All-Ireland League if it was done fairly and rightly. As I say, the away trips are great crack, like, you know. And Shamrock Rovers Limfield would create, you know, a media frenzy. Every time we go down there, they've invited us into their social club, put on like a spread, sandwiches and stuff, and the bar and stuff for us before the game, and mingling with their supporters.
It's funny just that the expectation, you know, even from now, going back 100 years, Belfast was the hub. Whereas, is it biased that we're in the south? I think that, oh, well, the Republic of Ireland almost, do we sort of see Northern Ireland as the lesser side, you know? I think that we ask the question of how many of the Northern Ireland lads would get into our side, and think not very many. Like in today's starting 11, what would that United Ireland team look like? It's just an interesting one, because in the past we can pinpoint, well, you can't leave him out, and they'd be great up front together. Now it's sort of like, I think they're very, very similar standards of teams.
Yeah, like, I don't think putting them together would improve either team, actually. It wouldn't disimprove them either, but you're swapping in like for like in almost every position on the field.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but I think that the Republic of Ireland, we still see ourselves as being, it was like, you know, okay, you shouldn't lose at home to Luxembourg, but at the same time, Are you thinking that it's the team that beat Holland 1-0 with Jason McAteer's goal that's out on the field against these lads? You know, sometimes I think, sometimes I fall into that trap as well. I was there when we beat Germany 1-0. You know, I was there when we beat Bosnia. I was like, but even then you go, wow, the difference in a couple of lads who are starting in the Premiership from a couple of boys who start in the Championship is massive at that level, you know?
I think we're probably fellas our age and a little older and a little younger, but kind of bang around our age. You came of age in Italia 90, where we basically for all of our lives up until very recently, we were better than Northern Ireland, but now we're not. We're about the same or there, probably slightly better. That's hard to, you don't adjust to that quickly. So that's, you definitely, my natural instinct would be to say we're stronger than Northern Ireland, but the reality is right now we're not.
Like, it's mad to think that we'd kill for a Johnny Evans.
You know? I was just looking up the squad there and I was thinking, oh, Johnny Evans, he'd fit in.
As fans of the Republic, of the age that we are, our expectation and our sense of where we sit in the world, not just relative to Northern Ireland, we have this expectation that actually we should be qualifying for tournaments because, well, we always did in the 90s. You know, we'd make 3 out of 4 sort of thing. Whereas actually, you look at our history, even including that golden period, it's more like we make 1 in 5. That's our level.
Yeah.
And the North are the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think what we're kind of saying here in a roundabout way is the question here is, what if we'd always had an All-Ireland team and an All-Ireland association? Internationally, we'd be about the same. And the league might be very slightly better. Is that a fairly accurate summation of what we think of?
Yeah, I mean, I think internationally, we might have made, you know, if between us we make, two in 10 tournaments, we maybe make 3 in 10. We make the odd extra one where we were a little bit short and even having one team instead of two would have just freed up an extra place in qualifying in the groups. So we might have made 1 or 2 extra. I don't think we go any further in any, like, our best tournament in Italia 90, we don't get past the quarterfinals just by having a couple of lads from Northern Border in the team. So we maybe make 1 or 2 extra tournaments, but we don't do any better in any of them, would be my sense internationally, certainly.
Yeah, I think it's 1 or 2 tournaments where the both squads could have melded together. You take 94. There's not many lads from that Northern Ireland team are going to be in the Irish squad or in the team anyway. I'm sure in recent years that the people, followers of Northern Ireland would say that they wouldn't want anyone off the Republic's team, you know, and you could make an absolute fair argument for that, that sometimes it's not the individuals, you know, it's the sum of the parts. And I sort of agree. I think that there's 1 or 2 years where they could have done better. But I also think, I also go back to my first kind of early point that sometimes it's the Wimbledon mentality, you know, that serve both nations quite well, in that it's the lads who can't get a game for their club who are just doing phenomenal when they put on the international jersey. And it's just the right time and the right place and the right manager or whatever it may be that gets Northern Ireland or Ireland over the line.
And domestically then, we think it's probably a healthier football culture, probably a healthier league and a healthier infrastructure and system. Probably better, but if we have to kind of call it and go, how much better could it be?
We might have got past the first round of European competition a couple more times, but never further.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is about this what if is that in terms of domestically, I think we will find out. I think we'll find out because I think it's something that will happen.
What about off the field? I mean, do we think that's actually the biggest impact of all?
Yeah, I think so. I football can be a very negative force in politics. We've seen numerous times, there was examples in the Balkans where some of the actual first physical fighting started happening. What was it? Dinamo Zagreb against Red Star Belgrade game. And not having a Northern Ireland and Ireland just had these two touch points, these two kind of identify as points of difference, and not having them there, I don't think it would have, I'm not sure it would have been a massive difference, but it might have made things just a little bit more relaxed at particularly heated moments.
I agree.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think where we're at now, I think, again, most people, we look back on the last 100 years and go, you know, let's never be like that again here. Obviously, in recent times, there's difficulties. But in terms of sport, I think that people are ready to say, even if we don't decide to have an All-Ireland team, I think people are ready to embrace sport, whether it be individuals like boxers. The rugby team, obviously, is what it is. But I think if it was a domestic league, I think it would just be the usual nonsense football rivalry and banter. I don't think it would. I think it would probably be ultimately a good thing. I think most genuine fans would like to see it. You know, I want to go and boo Linfield, like I want to go and boo Bowes, you know. And I think, I definitely hope to see it.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Outside the Box. If you think things would have played out very differently, or if you think we nailed it here, we'd love to hear from you.
Or if you have any ideas for other interesting what-ifs, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at whatiffootypod, or by email at outsidetheboxwhatif@gmail.com. We hope you tune in again next week. Please tell your friends if you liked the show, and even if you didn't, tell them you did. I've been Dave Fleming.
And I've been Jared O'Shea. And as we sit here virtually shoulder to shoulder in different counties, there's only one way to finish. This has been Outside the Box. We're answering Ireland's call.